It's time for class.
Civics just doesn't begin and end on election day.
This is Sunday Civics, the home for the civically engaged with political strategist L. Joy Williams on Sirius XM's Urban View.
Welcome, welcome to Sunday Civics, the home for the civically engaged here on Sirius XM Urban View Channel 126. I'm your host and civics teacher, L. Joy Williams, and for class today, we're going to talk about military families. Now, when you think or speak of the military, quite often the conversation is focused on war, or if we're going to war, international conflict all across the world, the ongoing fight over the military budget, or what I call the war toys, the weapons, the planes, and the bombs, which, side note, have you seen the military post Instagram and Twitter post about like new planes and bombs? It's very disturbing. But anyway, connected to every soldier, squad leader, commander, or lieutenant is their family. I have my own military story. My father was in the military, and it's the reason I was born in Kansas, because he was stationed there at the time. And although I spent majority of my childhood in New York, I also lived with my mom, my stepfather, and my sisters on the military base Fort Irwin, and actually went to high school there. And so some of you listening to the show may also have your own military story connected to someone in the military, a military brat, if you will. So we have guests today talking about what military families are experiencing right now. Our first guest, join me for a conversation about military spouses and about the issue of sexual assault in the military. Take a listen. We have a lot to learn about those who serve in the military. And in today's conversation, I have with me Joy Craig, who's a 23-year Marine veteran, and Liesl Kershaw, a Marine pilot's spouse, who's going to talk to us about their work, their advocacy within the military, specifically around sexual assault. So, Joy, thank you very much for coming on the show.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you so much.
So we met at South by Southwest, and, you know, you and Liesl came into the green room and were nervous about the conversation.
Yeah.
But I immediately was interested and wish our panels weren't at the same time,
was
immediately interested in this topic because my senator has advocated a lot on this issue, but quite honestly, I haven't really been completely tuned in. Mm-hmm. And so talk to me about the work and the advocacy you do.
Okay, I'm happy to, and thank you again for having us today. Liesl and I met a couple years ago, and it was right after I retired from the Marine Corps. We met in New York at a writing fellowship that was shared, and getting to know her and getting to compare some stories and get some things off my chest, I really needed a strong friend at the time, and she served as that for me. It made me take stock of some of the experiences that I had in the Marine Corps and look at them in a new light with some more mature eyes, with a fresh view, and the sexual assaults that I suffered in the Marine Corps kind of came to the surface and really bubbled. Over the conversations we've had over the past couple of years, she's helped me kind of process these things. And together we've been stepping into the advocacy to help fight sexual assault in the military, because there are young women serving right now today that will suffer from sexual assault. It's kind of a pandemic in the military, and it's underreported and under outraged by America.
Why is it underreported? Is it the same thing as sexual assault in general in terms of women? They don't want to be singled out. They want to be part of the, you know, team, is sort of not seen as a part. Is it shame? Is it all of those things that we already know about women facing sexual assault?
Yeah, it is. And then you have the added bonus of being in a very small fishbowl. And in my case, I was in the Marine Corps, which is the smallest of the military services, but we boast the largest number of sexual assaults out of any of the branches.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty shameful. And the Marine Corps leadership knows about it. There was a scandal in early 2017 called the Marines United scandal, where a Google Drive was accessible to 35,000 current and former Marines and a closed Facebook page. And the Google Drive contained thousands of images of women that a lot of them had been taken surreptitiously. And it was determined through the investigation that a lot of those were service women who had shared photos maybe with their boyfriend, but then they had been uploaded onto this
wow.
public site for everybody to comment on. And there were some really vile comments. When the story of this Facebook page broke and it went viral in the military community, at least, the Commandant of the Marine Corps had to go up to sit in front of Senate and kind of tap dance for it. But aside of that, I haven't seen a whole lot of effort in trying to actively squash the sexual assault numbers in the Marine Corps. Mm.
And so what does advocacy on this issue look like for you on an ongoing basis?
It's an everyday fight. It's an everyday education. It's constantly being in the books and reading articles and listening to stories, writing my own story, encouraging other women like myself to write and tell their stories. It's hard. It's scary because I don't know what it is, but people don't want you to tell these stories. They don't want you to tell your truth. And the truth is that it's the masculinity, and I dare say the toxic masculinity that is pervasive. It has serious effects on victims, both men and women. There's a huge unreported swath of men who are sexually violated while they're in the military, and they don't report for a million taboos. And because we've been trained from day one of boot camp, you've been trained that women are to be quiet and be a concession, basically. We're supposed to be seen but not heard, kind of. And I know there's some female Marines that would disagree with me, but that's my truth. And the men have been trained a certain way. We've all been groomed to a certain position in the Marine Corps.
Mm. So, Lisa, I want to bring you into the conversation and talk about your relationship of support with Joy. I saw the description of your conversation and panel before, which was unlikely, but I actually don't see it as unlikely, but it was described as unlikely to sort of have this support, this partnership and friendship with as a spouse with a service woman.
Absolutely. So there is a sometimes an unacknowledged, in certain sections, an unacknowledged rift between female service members, women service members, and women spouses. That's because our husbands work with these women day in, day out. They deploy with these women. They have a certain set of experiences with these women that we don't see. They know a different side of our husbands. And there is I won't put it nicely. There is a toxic masculinity inside the Marine Corps that allows for the objectification in women. The way that a lot of Marines blow off steam is by going to strip clubs, mm-hmm. by when they're on deployment in places like Asia, having sex with prostitutes that are typically trafficked women, right? And then they come home from deployments, and Joy has seen and witnessed all these things, and it puts an impossible rift between the two of us. If she has witnessed somebody's husband, and I will say, perform a sex act on a stripper,
right,
and turn that woman into a sex worker in that moment, and then she comes home, and she has to be friends with that woman and go to a, unit barbecue.
I can imagine that's a different, just the tension that may exist between families as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then there's, I'm a military spouse. I'm a longtime military spouse. I've been with my Marine for 17 years and he's still active duty. And I love the military spouse community there. It is made up of incredibly kind, thoughtful, giving, caring, sacrificing people, right? And men and women. But one of the things that often our careers are cut off at the knees, right? There's not a lot of opportunity for military spouses. We are overeducated and underemployed as a population. And so some of that, and in my own, and I will speak for myself, looking at strong, beautiful women like Joy who have successful careers, some of it is envy too, right? I'm an applied psychologist by trade, and it's tough when you've moved 12 times in 17 years to cobble together any sort of career
yeah.
in your field. And so sometimes the outlet is, oh God, she's beautiful and she's powerful and she's, you know, so there's some feelings of envy there too that cause that rift.
That's interesting. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Sunday Civics. You know, I'm my father was in the military. My stepfather was in the military. My mom now works adjacent. So she, as you're saying, got overeducated. She's now working on her PhD. And she's a patient advocate for at a military hospital, right? And so just thinking about, you know, I had my own experiences, you know, growing up on a military base, particularly during high school. And I remember my parents not wanting me. As you get a certain age, they don't want you to be next to the, like, new recruit, because right, they're so close to your age. And I remember my mom not having a lot of friends, that it was only spouses. Like, there were very few friendships or none at all that she had with actual women who were actually, you know, service women, mm-hmm. you know, and living on the base and sort of having to engage with women and everything. But it was more, you know, people from the church or things like that that were spouses, not as those in service.
Lisa and I call that the divide and conquer tactic. They keep women isolated. A lot of spouses are isolated from their peer group on purpose by their husbands, and that's it's a pretty broad stroke, and I don't mean to imply that, but we've heard some between Lisa and I. Her husband is commanding officer right now of a command in San Diego, and between the two of us, we could probably tell you a dozen stories of women who their husbands forbade them to make friends with myself or Lisa or a coworker or another spouse. There's some controlling measures there too.
Mm, that's interesting. So Lisa, talk about how you've supported Joy in her advocacy on sexual assault in the military.
So when Joy and I met in Manhattan a couple of years ago, we sat down at an Indian restaurant close to Ground Zero, where we'd been for the day, and we just started having this conversation, and oh my gosh, we must have sat there for 4 hours.
Wow.
And we closed that place down, and Joy would tell me story after story after story, some of which were familiar to me, and some of which were really flabbergasting. She talked about how she'd been ostracized by my community, how she really needed female friendship. So there's only 5%. When Joy joined the Marine Corps, there were only 5% women. Now there's about 9% women. So there's just not very many, right? And she really craved the companionship of women, and she didn't have it. And she was ostracized from my military spouse's sorority in a really ugly way. When she told me those stories, my hackles got up, and I was kind of offended at first. And I know myself well enough at this point in my life that if somebody says something that's not true about me or my community, I'll let it roll off, whatever. But if somebody says something that is true,
it convicts you.
It bothers me, right? I feel those hackles go, and I get, you know, I think that's it's that immediate knee-jerk reaction of, but not me, right? And that's...
It's like when people, like, their immediate jerk reaction when you're saying something is racist, and they're like, I'm not racist. I'm talking about, but okay, what you did was racist.
Exactly, right? And so I had that knee-jerky kind of moment, and I like to think that Joy maybe didn't see it at that dinner. And I tried to listen and open myself up to it and lean into that discomfort and say, oh my, this is this woman's lived experience. This is her lived truth. And I went home that night, and I didn't sleep at all. And we had a lot of work to do the next day, so I was kind of a wreck. And I just thought about it, and I thought, how have I been complicit in this system? What have I done? When have I not spoken up? I like to think of myself as kind of a nice person who likes people, so I don't think I've been particularly unwelcoming to anyone. But I have absolutely been silent when I've heard other military spouses or male Marines malign female Marines in a way that is sexist, that, you know, just reinforces gender stereotypes that are misogynistic. And I'll give you a brief example. I was at a unit barbecue, and I heard some of my girlfriends, we were talking about the Marines United scandal, And full disclosure, both of us have written for the outlet, The War Horse, that broke that scandal. And I was listening to their conversation, and the general consensus at that barbecue was those women were sluts and they deserved it. And I didn't say anything. And that's one of my moments of great shame in my life, because I know that that's not true. Women who are exploited, I'm an applied psychologist by trade. I know that that's not true. And I was silent, and that thoughtlessness and that complicity, that's part of the problem, right? So the Marine Corps has a culture problem, and we need, and to protect women from sexual assault, we really need to fix that culture. It doesn't just happen from the top down. Like, the Marine Corps is really good at issuing top down orders. It's what they do, right? So they've passed there's no democracy in the Marine Corps. I don't know why I'm talking about that. They've have issued prohibited activities and conduct orders, things like that, that give commanders big leeway to punish harassment of protected statuses, including gender. But that's not the only fix, right? That change has to come from the ground up too. And part of that is integrating boot camp. The Marine Corps boot camp is still segregated between men and women. And in that indoctrination process, the drill instructors, the male drill instructors, knowingly or not, consciously or not, often indoctrinate their recruits with sexist and with sexist ideology and gender stereotypes, right? They talk about women as pussies, all sorts of things, right? So they teach their recruits from the very beginning that women are not as strong, that women are other, that women are lesser. They equate being a woman with being weak, right? That term, you run like a girl, those sorts of things. But the other part of that culture change is that kind of lateral influence, the relational power that spouses like me hold. And that's speaking up in my community. That's one of the things I can do. I can lean on my husband and say, this is not right. I can lean on my girlfriends because I have access to this community. And I can say, wait, no, that's not true. Let's talk about it. And that's part of creating culture shift, is changing that normalized social script that we see. And that normalized social script is incredibly, in a lot of ways, gender stereotyped and sexist, which is what breeds sexual assaults, right? Yeah.
Joy, Liesl talked about some of the changes that need to happen from a structural standpoint. And then there are also the cultural things. And quite honestly, whether it's dealing with issues of any marginalized groups, the focus of the structure is, they'll focus on the cultural change piece because it doesn't require them to actually act, right? Or, mm-hmm. Change or something, or they'll do the excuse it away, or, that was the ogre, or boys will be boys, they'll do all mm-hmm. of that. And they want to focus on the cultural change, because if you focus on structural change, it requires you to say that the system itself is broken and the system itself is the problem. Mm-hmm. Do you find, I've heard people say, well, the more young people that'll get in the institution or whatever, it'll change.
You'd think so, but no, they're the ones at the top are holding on to the old mentality pretty firmly. I had the pleasure of meeting with a staffer for Tim Scott's office about a year ago. I was representing the Service Women's Action Network, SWAN, up on Capitol Hill. We stormed the Hill one day, and I was trying to pitch the Military Justice Improvement Act to Senator Scott's staffer to please pass along my encouragement that he support this legislation. I practically got laughed out of the room. He said, oh, we're getting big pushback from the generals on that one. And I about came across the table of the poor kid. I said, the generals aren't the ones in the barracks getting raped. That's not who matters here. I don't care what the generals say. It's not their freaking problem. And for them to not protect those E1s, E2s, E3s that are in the barracks that are being preyed upon, it's inconceivable. I don't understand how they sleep at night, because they are, who doesn't want to protect victims of sexual assault? Men and women, and the male numbers are pretty pretty astounding if you were to look at them.
And who doesn't want to protect their soldiers?
Exactly. Who doesn't?
Right.
Unit cohesion. Honestly, I think it's a matter of national security that they tackle this problem properly.
So that's part of what we talk about when we have this conversation with people, because convincing people in our community is pretty difficult that structural change needs to happen as well as a cultural shift, because the structure can help dictate that culture, right? But one of the things that that we really struggle with is we get pushback because the Marine Corps is not a social experiment. It does not exist to make women feel better about themselves. We know that. Mm-hmm. The Marine Corps exists to fight and win our nation's battles, but they can't do that if they have a segment of their population who is being victimized and violated and are not part of their team. They're not integrated into the whole. And so that becomes, like Joy just said, a national security issue.
I think so.
It becomes...
And I will say this about Paris Island. It's the one place where they do train female recruits. They are trying to make strides. They're toying with the idea of treating women equally. Right now there's one platoon of female recruits that's going through boot camp and training with alongside male counterparts for the very first time. It's 2019, the very first time they've even entertained the idea of integrating boot camp. And it is a good stride in the right direction, absolutely. But I was a drill instructor halfway through my career, and I did see that masculinity, that toxic masculinity, the misogyny passed down from generation to generation, from male drill instructor to male recruit. And when that recruit becomes a drill instructor 10 years into his career, he passes it down to his new recruits. And it's just, there needs to be a break in that chain. There has to be a break in that cycle.
Talk a bit about what are some of the things that we can do, that the Marine Corps can do, that the general, like, what are some immediate strategies or immediate actions that can immediately be taken to address the issue?
Yeah, I think the first bit of, they're starting at Paris Island and trying to integrate training a little bit more, that's a good first step. Holding commanders accountable for protecting predators, which is what the Military Justice Improvement Act is trying to help pass. As it stands right now under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the commanding officer level, they can act as sole judge, jury, and executioner on any sexual assault case that comes under their purview. If the victim falls under down their chain of command, they can choose whether to investigate and prosecute or completely toss the entire thing out or do nothing about it, just ignore it, basically. And these commanding officers, many times, most of them are not lawyers. They get a couple of days worth of classes on how to navigate the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ, but they're not experts. And so many times, because so many women victims are sexually assaulted by somebody in their chain of command, it makes it really hard for them to report, because reprisal is a huge living, breathing beast in the Marine Corps.
Wait a minute. I've watched a TV show where there's like military lawyers and they
no,
do like, invest- that's no, not what happens?
No, ma'am. Not true.
I thought like they do, what no. was it, JAG or something? Like, no, it doesn't happen?
No, ma'am. Sorry to disappoint you. I wish it did. I wish every single one of those claims went to a court-martial or some sort of adjudication, but most of them overwhelmingly are tossed out by the commanding officers. And a lot of that has to do with the guy that's accused, the guy that's been preying on this poor girl or this victim is the go-to guy in the squadron. He's the man. And we won't want to ruin that guy's career. Or sometimes you'll hear, well, he's married. We don't want to ruin his family. You're going to ruin his family.
And
heaven forbid.
Heaven forbid.
And the other part of this is too, is, and this is the same across America, is because women are not believed. Women are not believed when they report sexual assaults. And it's interesting because, and I've seen it in the Marine Corps community, when men report a sexual assault, they're more often to be believed, but a woman, no. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of mine and Joy's friendship, and part of kind of the hard work that I did with myself is, you know what, I believed her story. When she told me her truth, that was the first step, is I believed her. And I think that's why we've begun, one of the reasons we've become such good friends and why we can do this work together. It starts with really taking that big step and saying, yes, I believe you.
And truthfully, outside of the spouses of the Marines I worked with, there's no other group of women who would get my experience better than you. And I could never go to somebody like, I mean, I that's not entirely true. I had plenty of spouse friends while I was in the Marine Corps. I make it sound like I didn't get along with anybody, but I did. I had some great friends, but I couldn't open up about my real truth because it would ruin her marriage potentially. It could ruin her marriage if I told her what I saw her husband do in Thailand or Guam or any of those places I traveled with them. And I digress. It's everything. Our partnership and female service members being able to have a safe place to go to, even if it's, I have to tell you something that your husband did to me while we were deployed together. Mm-hmm. That I have to have somewhere to go with that. Mm-hmm. And I, again, outside of a military spouse, I don't know anybody that gets that better than my sisters in arms, my other service members. And they're so few and far between. These poor girls are so isolated. It's one of the oldest fraternities in the nation.
And that's one of the other big pushbacks we get from the military spouse community. It's one of the kind of through lines that we see is, I don't have anything in common with Joy, right? Like, why isn't Joy just spending more time with the Marines? We're at barbecues or whatever. Why does Joy want to be with the spouses? Well, because women have mutual interests, political, cultural, social, mutual interest. That's why, right? So no, you know, I don't understand Joy's lived experience from the fact that she's a Marine. I've never been a Marine. I've only ever been a Marine spouse. So I've got some idea of what's going on and I understand our culture, but it's, you know, there's no reason we shouldn't be allies and honestly accomplices in dismantling the system.
Yes. And that's our plan.
I love it. Accomplices, not allies. Well, thank you very much to both of you for joining us on the show and talking to us about this issue. We'll be talking more after the break about the Military Justice Improvement Act, and then what we can do to engage our legislators and make sure that they are co-sponsors or supporters of the legislation and move the issue forward. And if you are a military spouse or if you are a service member in any branch of the military, we'd love to hear from you as well about the advocacy work that you would like to see and making the experience safer for those who serve our country. We'll be right back.
How can it be that you love the most unlovable part of me? Of me. How could you see? Your life was the only gift I'll ever need to be free. It's amazing with you.
Welcome back to Sunday Civics. We're continuing our conversation talking about military families, military spouses. And I'm so glad that I've been introduced to Joy Craig and Liesl. They're now part of the Sunday Civics community. So shout out to you ladies. Another woman I was introduced to, a Marine spouse, Crystal Cornwall, is a military housing advocate. And I want to begin our conversation. You remember that a civic action that you can participate in is testifying, whether it's before Congress, your state legislature, or city council, about issues that are happening in your community, or if you are an expert or an advocate on an issue. And I want to begin this next segment. I want you to listen to Crystal Cornwall, who testified earlier this year about the substandard conditions of housing for military families. I want you to listen to her testimony before Congress, and then she'll join us for the continuing conversation.
So we'll start with you, Ms. Cornwell. You are recognized.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for the invitation to participate in today's hearing. I am Crystal Cornwall, the proud spouse of a Marine of 11 years, a passionate military family advocate, and founder of the nonprofit Safe Military Housing Initiative. I'm currently a finance professional, a former police officer, and have a bachelor's in public administration, and am working towards a master's degree. In many ways, I am like every other military spouse. We are at our fourth duty station and are anticipating a geo-batch tour in the fall. For the next 3 years, my husband will serve away from our family. Our three children have only known their father preparing for or deploying to war. a war that has endured 18 long years. I'm here today on behalf of military families of every branch and rank. We ask that you act on our testimony and ensure military families receive safe, habitable, and functional housing and a better, more accountable way to resolve problems that arise. I first became aware of the crisis-level military housing issues at Keesler Air Force Base, where termites fell out of light fixtures into our beds. Later at Camp Pendleton, we lived with pervasive mold issues and unjustifiable move-out charges. At Keesler, the housing office staff told me, termites in your home are to be expected because of the region. At Camp Pendleton, we were inexplicably charged almost $700 for carpet replacement. The housing rep used a black light and moisture stick to find stains unseen by the naked eye. When I disputed the validity of these charges, I found no path to resolution with the housing company, Camp Pendleton, or my husband's former command. In the end, various agencies and local attorneys advised us that military families living on the bases are essentially powerless in these disputes. During my 2 years of research and advocacy, I received hundreds of reports from military families of mold growth, rodent and pest infestations, moisture intrusion, lead and asbestos exposures, radon concerns, base contamination, and cancer clusters in their housing. All of this was too often compounded by defensive, sometimes abusive housing staff. With other military families, I have witnessed the peeling paint inside and outside of the homes at Fort Belvoir. I have felt the helplessness of a fellow Marine Corps spouse as she held her new baby and sobbed while we stood under a collapsing, moldy ceiling in her home at Camp Lejeune. I listened in horror as families at Camp Pendleton told of mice eating through pacifiers in their babies' cribs and electrical outlets catching fire due to wiring issues. I've crawled into an attic at Keesler Air Force Base and measured the moisture intrusion from a roof leak. And I have been to the town halls where families were dismissed, and they also feared retaliation for reporting their concerns. Today, you will hear from the corporate housing company executives testifying that they were unaware of these problems and that their own surveys show they are fulfilling the terms of their government contracts. They, and some of those in command, will also say military families are not reporting housing issues through official channels. That's just not accurate in my experience and in those of other military families. In fact, that's what military families do. We follow the rules. Until recent media reports and today's hearing, our efforts to fight for safe housing were too often met with intimidation, personal attacks, and strategic attempts to discredit us and silence our voices. We are appalled by this response. But looking ahead, we offer three recommendations to address the military housing crisis. Amend or cancel the 50-year privatized contracts to allow for competition, proper oversight, and accountability. Provide a clear and accessible path to administrative or legal recourse when necessary. As with civilian counterparts, military families should be able to withhold their basic housing allowances until their homes are safe and habitable. Military families understand that quality housing does not mean entitlement to elegant mansions. We simply ask for homes free of mold, pest, lead, and other hazards. We expect homes free from the stressors of deployments, workups, training, and the day-to-day military service. As parents, we want safe places for our children to sleep at night. Thank you for your time today and commitment to resolving military housing crisis. We look forward to working with you to create solutions. As military families, we do our part. We ask that those who are paid to support us do theirs.
Well, thank you very much for the excellent statement, Ms. Cornwall.
Yes, sir.
Crystal, thank you so very much for joining me for this conversation. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having us. I hope that you're doing well as well.
Yes, definitely. So, you know, I had a conversation, as I mentioned to you, with Lizel and Joy Craig, who are also on the show this morning, about military families in general, because we have what the general public gets in terms of military is it's just focus on the soldier and our military overall, the power of our military, the military toys, the military, you know, how strong our military is. And as speaking as someone who, you know, is a military brat, I guess you can say, is, you know, talking about the families and the other support that is necessary to support that soldier, but then also that makes sacrifices to be in the military overall. Can you tell us a little bit about setting that stage of what we should be thinking about besides just thinking about the individual soldier, which we should do, but, you know, thinking holistically?
No, absolutely. You know, military families have a critical role in the readiness and retention of the, you know, the service member. Typically, when you, well, the military says that when you recruit the service member, you retain the family. And that is very, very true. And one of the things that we should always be considering holistically is what is happening with military families? What are their needs? And we do have a lot of resources out there that do address some of those needs. But sometimes I think it's good to refocus and see how the military is changing, both with technology and also the endurance of an 18-year-long war. You know, those needs of military families is changing, and I think that we need to ensure that we address that.
Absolutely. Now, I've been, you know, as I said at the top of the show, you know, my father was in the military. I was born, you know, on a military base in Kansas, mm-hmm. and, you know, spent high school on Fort Irwin. And, mm-hmm. you know, lived in military housing on base. And it surprised mm-hmm. me, this conversation that, you know, I don't feel is getting enough national attention because I certainly didn't hear about it until being introduced to you about the status mm-hmm. of military housing. Talk a bit about that.
Well, to be honest with you, I was kind of shocked as well. I've been a military spouse for almost 11 years. We've been married 11 years. I was a military spouse before I met my husband. I was married 4 and lived in military housing. When I first started researching this in July 2017, we had a poor experience in housing, and that's kind of what prompted me into this situation. I did not realize how systemic the problem was. I really, truly had no idea. And there were things in my home that I didn't realize were actually a problem. I didn't recognize them. And I suspect that a lot of military families, you know, are in the same boat that I was, where we don't recognize those issues. So like you, I was very surprised. And I do think that there is a big disconnect between the general public and what they believe is happening with military families and with service members. For example, the military public believes that we get free housing. Unfortunately, that's not the case. I wish it were the case. We get our husbands, our spouses, our wives, whatever, they all get an entitlement for base housing. And that money goes straight, oftentimes, straight to the PPV. The PPV is the contractor on the base who manages the housing company, the housing project. And there's a big disconnect between what they think is happening and what is really happening. And the other disconnect, too, is that from my personal experience, I did not have recourse to get my housing issue addressed like you typically would if you lived off base. You know, there was no one on base that had the authority to address the housing issue effectively. That came from the military side, the DOD side, the legislative side, all the people that had a hand in writing these contracts. Nobody could do anything about it, at least from my experience. So I believe that there is this systemic issue. And today, right now, it appears that some of the housing groups, like Lincoln Military Housing, from our conversations with the executives there, they do agree that there's a problem. And they are hearing military families and hearing military spouses about what those issues are at various bases. And they are working, apparently, I mean, it appears to me that they're working towards trying to get those things addressed. But I think that we forget that it's not just the PPV. The military and the DOD and Congress and Senate all had a hand to play in all this. The Congress and the Senate are the ones that initiated legislation in 1996 and failed to continually review it and address it throughout the years, throughout the tenure of the project. And then, of course, the DOD failed to execute proper oversight, and the contracts, you know, they're a big issue. So it's not just the PPV. This is a collective effort at failure. So I think that we need to remember how all this plays a part and how everybody's little piece has, you know, affected the systemic problem.
Well, you know, let's back up a second because I agree with you. There's lots of failures up and down the chain, yeah. and people we need to help and institutions we need to hold accountable for this. But let's go back a bit mm-hmm. and talk about what are we talking about in terms of substandard housing or problems with the housing, just to give people a clear indication. We're not just talking about, sure. you know, oh, I don't have enough space for my family. We're talking about some real issues here of mold and water contamination, right?
We're talking about legitimate health and safety and economic issues. To me, all issues are valid, whether it's a move-out charge or if it's a health and safety issue. It is all valid because it affects the readiness of the family. You know, sometimes more so than others because obviously health and safety, they're priority issues. But we're talking about excessive move-out charges. We're talking about reset issues like the Residential Energy Conservation Program. We're talking about mold exposure, lead exposure, asbestos, radon. Different contamination in the soil. We're talking about a myriad of issues that are affecting the health and safety of military families. And when they're looking at this long-term or 30 to 50 years from now in that project, they have these big accounts that money set aside for sustainment later. But what they're doing is instead of addressing the issues now, those 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds who are in the housing now, they're not going to be able to join when they're 19, 20 years old because they've been poisoned in the housing today. So that's where the readiness and retention comes in and the recruitment side. So, you know, these issues are affecting, I mean, these are like real national security issues. These are health and safety issues of a population of people that you think are tough and strong, but they have nowhere to go to get their housing issues addressed when the PPV fails or the military fails or the legislative body fails. The only place that they have left is litigation. That's all they have. So that's how bad this is.
So referring to that and talking about in your earlier point of not having anywhere to mm-hmm. go, right? So military families, right. you know, and just thinking about the connection of this issue in terms of housing, health, and safety, when there are similar right. Conversations about public housing in cities all across mm-hmm. the country that are facing the same issue. Here in New York City, where we have a crisis Absolutely. Where public housing with lead exposure, all right? Mm-hmm. And then that argument is used to say, well, this is why government shouldn't provide housing and we should go private. But then there's a problem with privatization of housing as right. well, right?
Privatization can work as long as you execute the proper oversight and mechanism to, you know, to affect like a dispute resolution process. If you have that in place, privatization can work. But if you forego any of that, basically you're signing over your responsibility to someone else to do the job. You're setting yourself up for failure. You still have to manage the contracts. You still have to manage the project. You still have to make sure the vendor is doing what they're supposed to do. And you have to listen to the residents. That's another key thing. If the residents are telling you there's a problem and you're not listening, which is what happened with us with the military, they thought we were crazy. They were like, this is not happening. This is isolated. You're lying. You're not being honest. That was the feedback we got. So you have to listen to the residents too.
Absolutely. And that's across the board. Like I said, this is a similar situation mm-hmm. happening in public housing across the country yeah. where people that live every day can tell you mm-hmm. what needs to be fixed, right. what the problems are, and this right. lack of accountability that there mm-hmm. is no one empowered. You know, it can feel frustrating, obviously. Living in a space of that nature, whether it's on a military base or, you know, in public housing in a city, and consistently mm-hmm. seeing the problems and voicing and saying, you know, here, you know, we're having an issue with black mold. We're having an issue with right. A flooding or a faulty wiring and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. And no one saying anything or sort of addressing the issue, and then years pass. And then you have mm-hmm. to take it to a legislative issue where you're talking mm-hmm. about where Congress then has a responsibility, right. the oversight of the contract, right? And they right. failed here. I mean, watching some of the testimony from the hearing earlier this year mm-hmm. at the Senate Armed Services Committee, where mm-hmm. I believe you testified as well.
I did.
Yeah.
I was the first to testify.
Yeah. In talking about some of this problem, and, you know, again, there is no national focus or conversation about this. And meanwhile, we, you know, the families are suffering, their spouses are in long tours, and we have a responsibility to take care of the families when we've asked them to go and fight wars mm-hmm. or, you know, continue to work out of the country.
Exactly. And the other side of this too is, you know, in addition, so I want to make the parallel too between the lower socioeconomic status. And I'm using that term very loosely, so, you know, listeners, please don't be upset with me, in terms of low-income housing, because those families also face retaliation, just like we face retaliation that affects our spouse's career, you know, and those families, just like military families, do not have the resources to fight that stuff in court. They simply don't. You know, I don't know any family who makes $15,000 a year is trying to pay still for child care and is getting a subsidy for, you know, for housing. And they have the ability to go to a retainer on an attorney for $3,000 or $5,000 for an illegal eviction. You know, that's not attainable. So they're kind of like a hostage, an economic hostage in that as well, just like we are. There's this misconception, well, just move out of military housing. If you don't like it, just move. Well, that's easy for you to say, but we've already probably moved to our 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th duty station, and we don't have the money to just move. That costs money. And in addition to just moving, we're having to replace items that have been damaged by mold that is you can't keep. Once mold has damaged your stuff, you can't keep it anymore unless you want to continue to be sick. So those are things that, you know, people always say to us, well, just move. Well, you know, if you knew how much my husband made, which is it's all online, how much we made.
Right.
If you knew how much my husband made, you would maybe rethink that conversation. And then they go back and say things like, well, maybe you don't budget well enough. Well, maybe you haven't moved in less, you know, every 3 years for the last, I don't know, 12 years and had to figure out a new job, losing a job, finding a new job, paying the deposits if you want to live off base, and all these other expenses that we take. They give us a little bit of a subsidy to move, but it is not nearly enough to cover the expense of actually moving and replacing all of our household goods that doesn't fit in our car for cross-country moves. You know, so there's an economic issue to this too that we aren't always addressing. It's a circle. Everything is a web, like everything is connected. And that's how our lives are.
Well, tell me, what do we do now? Obviously, there are military families like yourself that are being vocal, that are organizing, mm-hmm. that are demanding accountability, that are demanding that not only the military, but the contractors and Congress sort of step up. What can we mm-hmm. do, or what should we be doing to continue to support these efforts?
Well, for military families, I think that we need to continue making sure we have our documentation, okay? Because at the end of the day, it's our word against theirs. Make sure that you have your documentation. Make sure you're writing your senators and your congressmen about things that are happening. Make sure that you're attending meetings. Make sure that you're going to town halls and things like that on the bases. Get involved. The more of us that band together and step up, the more power that we have as a group. As far as the civilians are concerned who don't have a military affiliation, what I ask of you is that you support us. You don't have to go on a military base. You don't have to. We're not asking for money. We're asking simply for your support and for your outrage in what is happening. You need to be supporting us in terms of writing your senator, writing your congressman, writing the staff, the Senate Armed Services Committee, and writing the HASS, the House Armed Services Committee, and telling them this is not going to stand and that they need to do their job. And that is where we can all work together and get the education piece of this, as well as some actionable items.
Well, Crystal, thank you so very much for joining us this morning. And we'll make sure to share all of this information so that people can, you know, write their representatives and provide mm-hmm. continued support on this issue and raise the alarm. And like eloquently made the connection between military families who are suffering these conditions and people in public housing or low-income housing, that this is the same the same situation, and that we should
Absolutely.
Be demanding
Very
action.
Parallel.
Demanding action on this overall. Thanks so much, Crystal.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Well, thank you so very much for listening to the show today. And remember, if you are a military spouse, military brat or kid, you're dealing with this issue, tweet at us at Sunday Civics or at L. Joy Williams. We want to uplift your stories. And for those of you who live in districts near military bases, you can provide support. You don't have to actually be a military family, but you can provide support by contacting your congressional members and asking them what are they doing on this issue, maybe joining in to support these families. And as Crystal made the connection, and as I said in our conversation with her, there is a direct connection between who the families are, who are in the military, who are in these housing conditions, as well as those who are in public housing. You know, believe me, June can do 16 episodes on this issue herself. And we have to be supportive on these issues and help raising the level of alarm that we shouldn't be comfortable with people living in these conditions at all, not in this modern society. So tweet at us, email us, continue to raise these issues. You can go to the website, sundaycivics.org, and see the videos, share them, and there are other suggestions on how you can take action on these issues. Thank you so very much for joining us. We'll be back next Sunday with more of Sunday Civics.